Well, my name is Teresa Hackett. I am the program manager for a copyright program at Electronic Information for Libraries. And I'll tell you a little bit more about Electronic Information for Libraries and the work that we do. But I manage and run the copyright program, which is a program on advocacy for access to information for librarians in developing and transition countries. I live in Dublin, in Ireland, and I'm based in Dublin in Ireland. I travel a lot around the world.
Second question, what's your passion?
My passion is relaxing. enjoying life.
This is good. Well, just a word of introduction. Teresa connects creative commons to our thought about libraries and becomes an advocate for an open net as a form of library. This is, to us, a step very much in the right direction. It, in a sense, has to do with mission of university. If one sees the mission of university as, for example, the RIAA and the MPAA would have us see it, it's to educate our students to produce copyrighted material and to respect the copyrights once produced. This, if you take that as the mission, makes the task of librarians to be to serve the interests of copyright. To me, this is a limited vision of the university's mission and is greatly in need of a change in polarity towards the open domain. And that's what Teresa represents.
Thank you. Well, thank you. And before I start talking, I'd like to introduce to you our members with whom we work in the many countries.
In your language, how do you say access to knowledge?
知识获取. In Chinese.
Access to knowledge. That's Lithuanian.
Access to knowledge.
Zugriff auf Wissen. My language is German.
Stupznai. Serbian language.
Well, there are several languages spoken in Nigeria. So there's not one language that you can use.
Biliyachur. It's Azerbaijani.
Yurtavastiat, Mr. Estonian.
Nzira. Yeruzio. Zimbabwe, Zimbabwe.
Ziwa Zanzeru. A language from Zambia.
We have at least 256 languages in Nigeria. Well, there are three major languages, and I don't know those languages.
To stop the informati.
The concept, I think, is not there. Not yet. Not yet.
I would like to thank the Berkman Center for the opportunity to talk to you today about the work that we do with libraries in developing and transition countries, and to, in particular, to thank Colin and Amar for facilitating my presentation. I thought it would be useful to put the idea of transition and developing libraries in context for you, whereby a developing country is defined as having a medium to low score on the Human Development Index. And in 2006, there were 32 countries listed as having low human development and 88 countries with medium human development and 57 with high human development. So in other words, there are more developing countries in the world than there are so-called developed countries. And then a transition country, on the other hand, is a country that's undergoing a transition to the market economy. This primarily refers to the countries of the former Soviet Union and Eastern and Southeast Europe. And transition countries tend to fall into the medium to high range in the Human Development Index. And of the 10 transition countries that joined the European Union in 2004 and 2007, they are all, in fact, now considered high in the Human Development Index. But nevertheless, all of these countries have undergone significant political, social, and economic upheavals over the last 15 years. And I would like to just show you the countries in which we're working, in which EIFL works, the geography of EIFL. Working in these 50 countries on three continents, we represent more than 2,200 academic, public, national research libraries, serving over 8.4 million library users and 3.8 million academic library users. But all of these countries have one thing in common, that is that they're all different. So every country has a different social, political, economic situation, which change over time, or in the case of some countries, might actually change quite quickly. So there's a great diversity. So there's no single formula for working in a country. Now, EIFL, Electronic Information for Libraries, began in 1999 as an initiative of the Open Society Institute, which is a grant-making foundation of the Soros Foundation, the George Soros Foundation. And it was recognizing the key role that libraries play in the exchange of ideas and knowledge and information and the development of open societies. OSI invested significantly in the modernization of libraries and library systems, particularly in the post-socialist countries of Central Europe and the former Soviet Union. And with traditionally sophisticated educational systems, these countries were emerging markets for the commercial providers of electronic information. But the barriers to accessing this information were formidable, because there was little money to pay for these very expensive electronic resources. There was a poor technological infrastructure. There was a lack of capacity amongst the library community and a relative lack of awareness of electronic resources and what you could do with the electronic resources. So this deprived libraries of the wealth of international information that was now out there and available to them. So I wanted to show you here our guiding principles, which are that access to information is essential for education and research and has a direct impact on the development of societies, that the combined purchasing power and negotiating power of libraries can lead to affordable and sustainable access to electronic information. And I think as librarians, you will be familiar with the consortium model. So this is essentially the consortium model, pooling the resources, empowering the community. And the empowerment of citizens and the spread of democracy depends on having equal access to information, and we are committed to leveling the playing field. So our mission is to lower these barriers that I spoke about earlier for libraries and for their users in poor transition and developing countries. The aim is to bundle the purchasing power, stimulating cooperation and resource sharing. And I think this is very important. We want to empower the library community. We do not give for free. So the libraries who have access to the electronic resources that they obtain access through our licenses pay for the resources. They select the resources. They manage the resources. And that's very important. So when we work in a country, we visit the country, we meet with the library community, we look at what is the particular situation in that library, what are the problems that the library community is facing, and then we work closely together with the library community to try and resolve these problems. So the way that we do this, we have two primary activities, which is to provide assistance in the provision of access to electronic resources, and secondly, to create and to support the development of library consortia in developing countries. And then over the years, a number of other program areas have been added. So content negotiation and licensing with electronic commercial information providers is the cornerstone of the work that we do. We have a number of publisher partners, which has grown steadily over the years. We cover all subjects, areas, all types of journals, databases, and increasingly electronic books. We have a model license, which is contains the fairest terms and conditions possible on the market for providing access to electronic resources through commercial publishers. And we get very good discounts on the very good pricing information from the licenses that we negotiate centrally with the publishers. But as I mentioned earlier, we negotiate the licenses centrally. The libraries, the consortia in the countries select which resources that they want to have access to. They manage the resources, they provide training in the resources, and they provide the resources as well. Sorry, they pay for the resources as well. So they must, so it encourages the sustainability. So sustainability is very important. Then in the countries we encourage the development and the strengthening of the consortia through training programs, through guidelines and advice in consortium management. The libraries in this way benefit from considerable savings to the resources that they have access to. They share their resources and the financial commitment amongst themselves, and they are empowered by speaking with one voice as a library community. Some of the other program areas that we've added over the years are open access publishing and institutional repositories, which is to encourage the greater visibility of locally produced content in the countries in which we work. So we're working with a number of leading institutions to establish institutional repositories in their libraries. We have a program on free and open source software for libraries. Very often, the integrated library system is the single biggest expense that a library will have. And in many of the countries in which we work, they will have obtained an automated library system through perhaps a one-off grant or from a donor. And they don't have the resources to maintain the system or to upgrade, to pay for the licenses to keep the system upgraded. So what we found was that many of them had obsolete library systems that were not where they couldn't develop the systems, they didn't have web OPACs, they weren't able to link them in with repository systems. So they were sitting there with obsolete library systems. So we have a pilot program where we're developing what we call a library in a box, which is modeled on another program called an NGO in a box, where we identify key library programs, free software programs, package them, and provide training then in installing them on easy to install platforms and common platforms. So that's one program area. And then there's my program area, which is the copyright program, advocacy for access to knowledge. And the goal here is to protect and promote the interests of libraries in copyright issues in the EIFL member countries. And I completely agree with your comments, Charlie, our message is the role of librarians to protect access to information. Of course, librarians respect copyright, we work within the copyright system, but if the copyright system, the copyright law is not fair, then we must advocate to change the copyright law. So the vision is that the EIFL librarians will become advocates and a strong voice for fair and balanced copyright laws in their countries, and that they will become leaders in promoting access to knowledge in their countries, and perhaps leading other communities, working with other communities and allies, the blind and visually impaired people, consumer groups, free software advocates. So we have created a network of copyright librarians in the countries in which we work. And we're also advocating at international level. So we work with the World Intellectual Property Organization. We take part in the meetings of the World Intellectual Property Organization, WIPO in Geneva. We've been very much involved in the development agenda for WIPO, which is aiming to reform WIPO and to encourage WIPO to have more development-oriented goals when new international IP treaties are being negotiated. And we've been an active partner in the Global Access to Knowledge campaign, which is a coalition of many different groups from many different sectors, all with one common shared vision, which is to provide and enable access to information, particularly in the electronic age. And we enabled the first ever librarian from Africa to attend a meeting at WIPO and to speak directly to the government officials who are negotiating treaties and norms, international norms in the copyright area, to speak directly and to provide an insight into the realities of trying to provide access to knowledge and information resources in a developing country. So, as you will all know as librarians, and I'm delighted to see so many librarians here, I really feel at home because I think wherever I go in the world, I think librarians speak a common language. You will know that digital technologies are transforming the way that we all work and that our services have changed dramatically over the last 20 years or so. And that the new technologies offer libraries wonderful new ways of providing access to information and of serving our users in new and innovative ways that simply wasn't possible before. So we have, for example, the British Library opening its treasures to the world in the Turning the Pages project. I don't know if you've ever seen that. It's a wonderful new, where you can really almost lift the pages of these treasures. It was a project by the National Library of Uganda and Books Anywhere, which provided a digital book mobile and print-on-demand centre for healthcare information and other books, which was able to go into rural areas of Uganda. And interestingly, one of the many of the most asked for resources by the people who the librarians met when they travelled around in this book mobile were restricted by copyright, and they simply were not able to provide what the people wanted because of copyright restrictions. And then the academic and the research libraries in the Eiffel countries where we're working are benefiting from access to dozens, hundreds of top quality in electronic journals from all over the world, and able to serve their users in a better way. So in future, students in Dakar or in Phnom Penh or in Kampala can have access to the same resources as a student here in Harvard or in Oxford through their libraries. And that's a wonderful thing. So it has I think the digital environment has the potential to transform access and use, particularly for economically disadvantaged areas or for rural areas. But there are problems, of course. And I think the question is, how do we address these problems? How do we overcome these problems? And that's one of the that's what our organization is trying to do. It's addressing the problems and trying to overcome the different barriers that we come across. So I'd like to just give you an idea of some of the areas, the barriers we've come across and how we're addressing the barriers, and then I'd like to have a discussion with yourselves and perhaps also get some of your ideas for how we can work to strengthen libraries in developing nations. The perennial problem, I think, for everybody, and you'll know this yourself, is the underfunding of libraries. We never have enough money. We're always looking for more money. But I think in the countries in which we work, this problem is particularly acute. So when Lithuania joined EIFELnet in 1999, not a single library offered access to electronic resources in the country. And library budgets for subscriptions were so low that universities could afford to subscribe to just a few foreign titles. So when the librarians formed a consortium, and they started to share their human and their financial resources for the purchase of electronic journals, they began jointly training students, jointly approaching the Ministry for Resources. Their funding has increased 40 times. So they are now offering access to 25,000 electronic journals through their library consortium in Lithuania. And the attitude of the government towards libraries has changed dramatically. They have become really respected partners, and the government recognizes the role of libraries in training and research in the country. And they started allocating special resources to the library consortium. The libraries in the countries in which we work are poorly resourced in terms of material. Now, in some countries, like in former Soviet Union, this may have been for ideological reasons. In Africa, it may be for economic reasons. But the electronic resources that they can have access through the licenses negotiated by EIFL, can redress this problem. But this in turn kind of brings another problem, in a sense, because it can go very quickly from a famine to a feast. So, for example, in one library in Laos, in which we were working, there were the library had on its shelves three dusty journals, and overnight, when their subscription to the electronic journals was switched on, they had 7,000 titles. So that's also, you know, brings issues of capacity and training, and ensuring that the resources are being used. And that there's an understanding of how to make the best use out of the resources. So simply having the resources there is in and of itself is not sufficient. So it brings issues of training and managing the resources. The other area, I think, is not a lack of coordination amongst the donor efforts. Now, libraries will receive donations from the West. But often these donations don't reflect the realities or the curriculum or the needs of the actual users. So there tends to be a focus on collecting books and collecting material rather than selecting the material. And it's not uncommon when you're going around libraries to see boxes of books that have never been unpacked, that have been donated but have never been unpacked. So the cornerstone of our approach, as I mentioned before, is that the libraries select their own resources. So they take control of the resources. So it's not simply just receiving and using what they've been given, that they actually make a decision amongst the library communities to what resources they want. And then that will then encourage then the library community to ensure that the resources are used, that the users, the students, know how to use the resources, and that they then have the incentive to go to their government or to the Ministry of Education or whoever it is to get funding to pay for the resources. The other problem area is lack of connectivity, simple lack of physical infrastructure in a country. Now, like other developing countries, Malawi benefits from initiatives to bring access to top quality electronic resources, such as through our own consortium and to others. And it was estimated that Malawi had access to over $3 million worth of electronic resources, which is great. But poor connectivity, mostly through dial-up modems, hampered the use of the resources. So in effect, they couldn't use them because it was simply too slow. So downloading articles was painfully slow, and some of the functionalities, such as the full text search possibilities, were just impossible. You just couldn't do them. So the Malawi Library and Information Consortium, MALICO, decided to take the initiative. And the result was a major infrastructure project, spearheaded by librarians, where they have introduced a high-speed internet network to the country through VSATs, very small aperture technology. So they've used this VSAT technology and placed the dishes strategically. Malawi is a very long, kind of skinny country, and they've placed them strategically in universities, four university sites throughout the country, to ensure that the whole country can have access. And now Malawi is able to participate in an academic research network and a research network for the whole of Africa. So bandwidth doubled overnight, quadrupled at two sites. They are now able to provide a host of new services for libraries, students, and other users. And that was done through the library community and through the library consortium. And then, as I mentioned earlier, the high cost of maintaining library software and library systems is a problem in many of the libraries. And in Palestine, Palestine territories, libraries had focused on proprietary solutions, mainly Microsoft applications. And the typical lifetime of a PC computer network in a school was 3 years, after which new versions of the operating system became necessary. And this was expensive, and it hampered the large-scale development, the large-scale introduction of computers into schools. And there was a project at Birzeit University in Palestine to switch to open-source software, which gave them considerable cost savings, especially in the education software, in the education sector. And as a result of some training which we provided to our country coordinator in Palestine, she was able to go back to her university, speak to the OSS people at her university, and they, within a couple of months, they had transformed lots of old computers which had been previously sitting around in the library into a high-speed computer network. The students couldn't believe it. And at the beginning, they wouldn't go to the computers to use them because they could see that they were old and they thought, no, these are going to be old, slow computers. But in fact, they had become much faster. And they were saying, what did you do with the computers? You've made them much faster. So they were able to really use the hardware they had. And I think the other very important thing is that it stimulates local innovation and local development within the software community in Palestine, who can then in turn contribute their work on the free software to the free software community around the world. So I think that's also important. So we try to redress this flow of information and skills from north to south to south to north as well. And then finally, the issue of professional library training and professional isolation. In some countries, there may be no professional library schools at all, no professionally trained librarians. Or in countries where there are professionally trained librarians, they may not have the training in electronic resources and digital material. So, and professional isolation is another issue, where librarians don't have the funds to travel to the international conferences and events and to take part in the global community and to share knowledge and resources, which I'm sure is very much part of your professional development. So we try to break through this knowledge barrier by providing a vibrant global community. And you saw some of our friends there on the DVD. We have a global meeting every year where everybody comes together, and we learn about latest developments and trends and the latest things that are happening in the hot information issues, open access publishing and other issues as well. So to encourage people when they go back to their countries that they can then be leaders in this whole area. But we work with very motivated people who have knowledge to share. And so we're imparting knowledge to them, they are imparting knowledge to us, and it's very interesting the dynamic with people from all over the world, but often working in similar situations, what they can bring to each other as well, learning from each other. And so we are fundraising to continue our efforts. We have a small, just to tell you a little bit of perhaps organizational information about us, we have a secretariat, an office which is based in Rome in Italy, and with some staff there. And then we have people working all over the world to provide input into our programs. So I'm in Dublin in Ireland. We have our open access and institutional repository person is in South Africa. We have our free software person is in Armenia. So we're really, I think, a global network working to provide access to knowledge around the world. And I think in this way we hope to contribute in a small way to provide equitable access to information and to contribute to a more humane world for us all. So that's really the end of my formal presentation or what I had prepared to say. I'm sure that you have some questions, and I would like to hear from you what are some of your experiences and ideas, and perhaps what would you what do you think would be the single most effective thing that we could do as a library community to strengthen library communities in developing and transition countries? Should it be, is it money? Is it knowledge? Is it reforming copyright laws? Is it partnering with institutions?
Is it mobilizing librarians?
Is it mobilizing librarians?
I think that possibly is the heart of it, because what you really need is the strongest voice you can possibly get. That way, the money will come from that, not necessarily what. So I think the consortium building and the getting the voice to be a single voice, and getting more American libraries knowledgeable. I didn't know about this.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the biggest problems that we encounter in countries in which we work is actually getting libraries to cooperate and to work together. Yeah. And that may seem kind of counterintuitive for librarians. We seem, you know, sharing resources, union catalogues, etc. But in countries where resources are scarce and where perhaps libraries have to compete, or different sectors or institutions have to compete with to get resources. Race to the bottom. So getting libraries to cooperate, and that's one of the challenges that we sometimes have when working in a country.
One thing that you didn't mention, and which I find the greatest challenge when I'm looking, particularly in Africa, is electricity. Seriously, I'm not being facetious. Many, many times I can't do what I want to do because there's no electricity. And I can't tell you how excited I would be. There was solar-powered computers, networks. It would make, I'm really asking you, is there anything there, out there, someone trying to develop solar power? Because the unreliability of the electricity is an absolute killer in at least 20 countries that I can think of in Africa.
Well, I'm not aware of any library initiative which is working with solar-powered computers, but there are some. I mean, the laptop, one laptop per child is not.
We have a solar panel to power the laptops. The laptops draw about half a watt of power in their low power mode.
You need solar-powered servers.
Yeah, connectivity, that's the other thing.
They automatically are configured to, you open one up, they form a network with each other and with the school server.
But what about internet? I mean, let's see, okay, the server, is the server at the school solar?
The server at the school is, well, there are commitments when a country comes on board with OLPC, there's a commitment to provide infrastructure. Now, sometimes that can be fiber optics, that can be microwave transmission, that can be satellite connectivity. In the next year, you're not going to see towns in remote parts of the developing world with connectivity all the time, but it will come. And the solar power can generate enough, and there's also standard generators. You're not going to see electricity the way we have it here right away.
I realize that, but I mean, like when I work in Ghana, 2 hours.
Yeah, so there are. This is just one initiative to power laptops and servers. There are others.
Oh, it is a real problem. I just many years ago, in a former existence, I was doing some training in library systems in Nigeria, and we were just about to start the training, and the power went down. But that quite often happened anyway. So you waited for a few minutes for the backup generator to kick in, and nothing happened. So I went out to see what was going on, and I looked around the corner, and there were these guys like fanning, kind of trying to fanning with doing something, trying to stop a fire in the backup generator. So they were trying to put out the flames in the backup generator. So my training was off for the day. So it is an issue, and not just in Africa, actually. I mean, also in some of the other former Soviet Union countries, I had a asked a question of my the librarians with whom I work, and a couple of weeks later got an answer from one of them apologizing for having for being late responding because the electricity in the academy had been down. So it is a problem.
Well, let us also remember that a lot of the most significant work in at least the Western traditions, well, and the Asian tradition too, was done in libraries without electricity. Electricity is a very recent innovation. Monastic libraries didn't have it. Locke, Hobbes, Rousseau didn't have electricity. Not Confucious. Often.
But the stuff exists.
Yeah. Useless. But electronic books.
And for electronic resources, yes.
So that does comfort me a little bit. What a lot of institutions do in Africa, well, I come from Nigeria, you know, talking about people banning, you know, I kind of was minding my business. Event, you know, for those who can invest in generators. What a lot of these invest in generators. And once in a while, the generators also, you know, are faulty. And so you have to have this scenario where people are mining, you know. So we get by. Now, if you're talking about solar energy, you are going to be dealing with governments. You are dealing with red tape. You are dealing with bureaucracy. And people, you know, trying to look out for their own, you know, pockets, so to say. So there's it's a long process, and it needs a lot of pushing, you know, a lot of pressure to get the governments going on solar energy.
But can I just say, in relation to that point about motivating the government, that's exactly what the librarians in Malawi did in this to get the VSATs. And in fact, they communicated with the regulatory authority and the licensing agency, and they were so impressed by the work and the benefit, the value that they saw of the access to research and education in their country, that they waived the import duties on the VSATs. Mm-hmm. And they reduced the licensing fee on the VSATs by 95%. So this was like librarians dealing with these regulatory agencies, communication authority, whom they would never normally have had any contact with at all. And I think it shows, when you have strong library leaders in a country, that you can actually spearhead initiatives that you wouldn't traditionally associate with libraries.
Two questions. One, could you comment on the pattern of countries which are currently part of your group, and second, do you differentially price services depending on income levels, or could you comment on that?
Yeah, well, in terms of this, the geography of where we're working, it kind of looks a little bit perhaps arbitrary, but we started, as I mentioned at the beginning, in the former the post-socialist countries and the former Soviet Union, particularly where the Open Society Institute was active. And then we began to expand our activities, partly in response to requests from librarians who wanted to join the consortium. So we then started to work in Africa. So we're down there in Southern Africa, in West Africa, in East Africa, a little bit in Southeast Asia, and more recently, and in Europe, of course, Eastern Europe, and then more recently in the Middle East. And we expanded the countries where we were working quite quickly. So we quickly went from working with a smaller number of countries to now 50 countries. And so for a couple of years, we stopped taking on new countries, because we wanted to consolidate the work that we were doing in the existing countries, because it's quite labor intensive. I mentioned to you that we visit the country, we work with the library community, we run training seminars in consortium building. And so, you know, we have limited resources, and so we need to consolidate what we're doing. But we are conscious that there are many other countries who would benefit from the licenses. And so we are currently looking to see if we can have some sort of a way that the countries can benefit from the licenses, but that they don't, that we don't have to invest so much in terms of time and resources to get them to do that, to have a sort of perhaps a mentoring system with our existing consortium members working with the new members. So we are actively looking at that. And then in terms of the pricing, the licenses that we negotiate centrally are available to all the members. Where there is differential pricing is in the membership fees. So the members do pay the countries, the consortium, pay membership fee to Eiffel to become members of the consortium. Now, this is for sustainability purposes, because it's important that the consortium can they see the value of the resources that they're getting, that they in turn can ask membership fees from their libraries, encourage the libraries for the consortium to grow, to approach their ministries to get support for the consortium work. And so we have differential pricing for the Eiffel consortium membership, depending on the economic development or the economic level of the country. And we have a lot of discussions about that internally as well, about the funding issue.
So just a question on this. So can an individual library in Malawi join, or does it have to be Eiffel, or does it have to be the Malawi consortium?
The individual library in Malawi would join the Malawi consortium.
So you only deal with consortium?
So we're like an umbrella organization for consortiums. Where it sounds a bit of a mouthful, but you're a librarian, so you'll get it. If I say this to non-librarians, they glaze over. We're an international consortium of library consortium, right? And I'm not aware of any other such consortia, because you've got national consortia, you have regional consortia, but we are the only international consortia. So we go to a publisher and we say, we negotiate access to resources not in one country or two countries, but in 50 countries. So that's the power of the our voice. Now, of course, in many cases, even when publishers discount their packages by 95%, the libraries in the Eiffel country still can't afford it. So in effect, we are able to provide free access in many cases to specific countries. Yes.
Have you had any countries that have had to drop out for any particular reason, and if so, why? Or are all the countries still being maintained?
No, it's different courses for horses. There are some countries that the consortia are at different stages of development in all of the countries. So some countries the consortia are very new, very young. In other countries they're at middle stages of development, and in other countries they're quite established. In some countries the consortia have registered as legal entities. In other countries they're not yet that far. In some countries they have their own constitution and governing board. So it's very, very different at countries at different stages. We have had countries that have dropped out, mainly because they haven't been able to form a consortium. And if the library community cannot, for some reason, or does not form a library consortia, then they cannot be a member of Eiffel, because we are a consortium. We work with this consortium model. So that would be, I think, the main reason we work with one consortium per country. And it has happened that you have like a very small country and you have like two consortia. And we encourage the two consortia to at least to work together and to form their own umbrella consortia and then come to us, because it's all about cooperating, sharing resources, strengthening the community, going with one voice to your the government officials to get funding and so on. Yes.
Of the commercial publishers that you have agreements with, what percentage are from developing countries?
What percentage of the publishers? I can't give you a specific answer to that question, because I don't actually do the content licensing, but they would be mainly international publishers. So they'd be the...
Dutch, you mean?
Dutch. Yes. Yes. It's the publishers and the aggregators with whom you deal with for providing access. Yes. Now, where there are publishers, where publishers from developing countries provide our work with aggregators, subscription agents, then of course, if the library has a subscription through that aggregator, then they will get access. But there is certainly an imbalance, and that's exactly the issue that we try to address with our open access publishing. It's to encourage, with our open access publishing program, it's to, and our institutional repositories, to encourage the visibility of more locally produced content.
So do you get a discount from Apple if you're an open access contributor?
Well, if you're an open, I'm not quite sure I understand your question.
So you charge the consortium membership fees. I mean, the libraries end up paying membership fees.
Yes.
If you wanted to encourage open access, you would give them a lower membership fee for a library that had developed an open access
publishing program. Yeah, I mean, we haven't worked with that yet, but the Open Access Publishing Program is relatively new, and we're piloting the development of institutional repositories with a couple of countries. We have in Zimbabwe, Lithuania, and a couple of other countries, and we're just in the stages of establishing the repository, installing the repository software, getting content for the repository. So perhaps further down the line, that might be an option.
Can I ask you a question about local databases? This is just an example of something that I would love to see protected, but they're all over the place. Ghana has a wonderful legal database, which they sell. You know, they have online access, but of course it doesn't matter since they don't have electricity, so you can never get to it. And they sell it by CD. But ideally, a consortium might also serve as the home for a lot of these really fine databases that they haven't got a good. They don't have a good way of delivering. So they can serve a model like Austerly or the Australian legal literature one, or the one for Micronesia, that it's situated in Vanuatu and holds all the databases and it's a reliable place.
So far.
Well, so far, yeah. Well, yeah,
I'll
you're right.
See you.
I know. Or until the French, they decide they're going to kill the French. But that's another question. So is that an aspect that you're looking at? Because I know some of those countries have wonderful things, but you can't get your little permits on them.
Well, I think it would depend on who is providing the database. I mean, is this a commercial database?
No. Let's say it's a university, or if it were commercial, the deal could be that if Ghana would supply you three of these fine databases, you would give them a glorious discount on data.
Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly the consortium, I mean, if there is such a fine database, I mean, that's, I think that would be exactly the sort of thing that the consortium in the country could at least start to provide countrywide access to. And then provided, I mean, there would be, you know, it depends on the status.
Is that happening anywhere?
Not that I'm aware of, no. But that's an idea. That's another idea I'll take back. Because we do have a strong consortium in Ghana and some strong librarians.
Access to certain products. I'm just wondering how you actually go about that. Like, what kind of considerations do you like put on the table? Which vendors, are there any strings attached? Are there any conditions?
No, we're just good negotiators.
Do the vendors require confidentiality, or do they advertise?
Well, we negotiate with the vendors. I mean, I think in many cases, we encourage the vendors to take a different approach, a different business model. Because as I mentioned earlier, that even if they discounted the package by 95%, it's still too much for many of the libraries. So we encourage them to take a different view and to say, okay, how much What's the amount of business that you do in this country at the moment? How much do you sell? And if they say, well, we don't sell anything, it's okay. Well, would you like to sell $100 worth? Or $200 or $500 or whatever it may be? And then maybe that's what you get this year. Next year, then you'll get more libraries joining. And then next year, there'll be more. And then the country, we have some countries now moving from one band into another band, into a higher category. So we encourage them to just look at it in a different way. And also it gives them an entry into an emerging market, because they know there's not really much commercial interest for them there at the moment, but it's an emerging market and there will be. And so the vendors like to work with partners with whom people they know. We can provide access to the library community. So they, you know, when they're first working in the country, that they have already the contacts.
But I heard the question as free access, open access. And here I'm a publisher on the other side, and you're asking me to give free access. What do you offer back to me?
Well, I heard the question in terms of free of charge access. Is that what you meant? Yes. So it's the cost is free, but the terms and conditions will be according to the license, and we negotiate the best terms and conditions that are possible, that are available on the market. So it's not open access, of course not. If you're working with a commercial publisher and the journal is not an open access journal, then you negotiate the terms and conditions of access and use through the license.
But still the question, what are you giving me?
I'm giving you.
What are you giving me?
Well, we're giving you access to the market. We're giving you access to the library community.
It sounds like we're access to give away to free.
Like, no, but publicity, basically.
It's heroin prices.
As I understand what you're saying, it's free publicity for the future.
Yeah, I mean, because the publishers, and this could only be done with the digital environment. So the digital environment enabled publishers to provide access to whole new countries at a marginal cost. I mean, it doesn't cost them nothing, but it's a marginal cost. So on the one hand, you have this opportunity. On the other hand, you have where the libraries are simply not able to afford it at the commercial prices, at the standard prices, and they don't have the ability to negotiate, or they're not familiar with the whole territory. So we're offering the publishers access into an emerging market.
Okay.
And we're helping to build a strong library community. So like publishers, well, here in the US, you would know the publishers would not like to have to negotiate individually with each one of you around the table for access to the same resources. They want you to come to them as a group, so that they can negotiate with you as a group.
But that's been done in this country, Charlie, 20 years ago.
Yeah, precisely.
If you graduated from law school, a West set up your little firm, a West representative would come and say, well, you have to have your United States Codanity. Here is a free set. You don't pay anything for these $200. All you have to do is sign this contract that you will pay the supplementation for the next 3 years. You know, get the thing in there, you get committed to use, and pretty soon it's indispensable, and then the price starts to go up.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a question for you. What, in your wildest imagination, could happen as a result of your coming here on this visit that would help you propel your mission forward?
Mm-hmm. I would love if you could all go back to your libraries and to your professional colleagues and associates and enthuse them about the work that we're doing. First of all, I would hope that I have enthused you about the work that we're doing, and that there's you can see the benefit and the value of the work that we're doing. And that you would spread the word in your own communities. and that we can get some support from the American library community in the work that we're doing in terms of human support, in terms of financial support, in terms of, that would be my. And that we can sustain the work that we're doing over a longer period.
Well, let me press you just one step further. Okay, I'm enthusiastic. I'm so enthusiastic, I'm ready to do something. But what do you want me to do? I'm going to talk to my friends. I'll get my wife enthusiastic. But she's going to ask me, what do you want me to do?
I feel like he's pressing us with that question, not you.
Well, no. It's a good question, and I think we would love you to help us with fundraising.
So you're here for money. That's basically what this.
No, and that's why I'm not giving you that direct answer that you really want.
Like three concrete operable tasks. Like, for instance, let's say, as Harvard releases its scholarship, bundles its scholarship in an open access way, like 40 open.
Really? Is that happening?
No, I'm just saying if. Let's say, so, you know, the departments get together, they're putting out these critical e-journals, all open source. Is that something that you would deliver to your clients?
Yes.
And you don't see that perhaps conflicting with the terms and conditions you've signed with these for-profit companies as potentially undermining the market that you've sort of promised?
Oh no,
them?
Totally not. I mean, we're in fact encouraging the development of the alternative business model. So we're not, which is what we're doing in the open access program.
So, a nice package of open electronic journals would be perhaps one of the four,
yes.
And maybe let's say two or three other discrete operable.
I like the idea of library community organizing and trying to, you know, have a more sensible, you know, copyright regime and things like that. But those are big tasks. And there are some things, I think, where libraries can just get out of the way. And sometimes that's the easiest place to start. And some examples I would give are, there's a long tradition for museum and library collections, special collections, things that aren't restricted by copyright, where we license access to them. So there have been very good reasons for doing that in the past, where people have said, you know, we've invested a lot to preserve these collections and make them accessible. And if you need a copy for your book, it isn't copyright that's keeping you from it, it's me, because I have the only copy of it. And you can have a copy under these terms, you know, at this price, if you don't do anything with it, if you promise not to do. Or their micro-publishing deals that libraries have done for years, where they say, in exchange for preserving this collection, the publisher is going to copy our special collections for free, but in exchange, we're not going to give them to anyone.
Right.
You know, that they're going to have to access our special collections there within our own institution through licensed resources. So I think there are some opportunities where we can just get out of the way. You know, there are things that we have at Harvard and lots of other privileged places that no one else has. And it becomes harder to make the case once you digitize collections that you should, you know, we're speaking out of both ends of our mouth. We're clamoring to get things into the public domain. And yet the things that are in the public domain that we are gatekeepers to, we're reluctant sometimes to open up access to. So I think that's something that hasn't been paid as much attention to. I think for the digital collections that Harvard's worked on, you know, the library's general position has been the broadest access possible. And usually that is left to some extent to local curators, but I think that's the position that the libraries as a whole has taken. But I think it's an issue with special collections, rare and unique materials.
I haven't spoken too much about my own program area, the copyright program area, but I mean there are probably two things that as a professional community that would certainly help me in my work, which is that the U.S. Government supports the development agenda at WIPO. And there's a crucial meeting in June in Geneva, which is the culmination of 2 years' discussion of this very important process. And the second one is the IP chapter in the bilateral trade agreements that your government signs with countries all around the world, which impose TRIPS plus obligations on developing nations. Copyright provisions that are, in some cases, stronger than you have here in your own countries, where you're exporting one side of the equation and not the other side of the equation. So, and in fact, Google has now become involved in the free trade agreement issue as well. I've just come from a conference in Yale where a Google representative was speaking specifically about a recent free trade, bilateral trade agreement between the US and Australia, where the library community was very active in opposing many of the changes. And as he pointed out, well, you know, you can't just export one side of it. Where you have these strong copyright provisions being placed on top of a system which doesn't have a fair use provision, because it's a different legal tradition. So they've bolted these one half of the equation onto a system that doesn't have a fair use pillar. So I think that would be another area. I mean, and that's very important, because I'm working with countries who are negotiating.
But you can't ask us to fight Disney. We'll lose. So, I mean, the only solution is to separate the commercial Disney type stuff from the scholarly Creative Commons type stuff.
Maybe. Yeah, well, I can ask you to fight Disney. And that's what we do. No. I think that's the part of the problem. It's the convergence of the platforms. So we're all the material is being delivered on the same platforms, and libraries now have the same rules as for scholarly material as you will for the latest Hollywood blockbuster.
I have a question that relates to what was asked earlier, and this has to do with the databases that as a result of this are being developed in each country. Is there any way that as a result, you know, year after year of internal databases being developed, there could be some repository in Eiffel that would have everything every of the 50 countries is internally developing? Because in America, we don't have access to the internal, you know, articles, books. Many countries are doing things we know nothing about. How could we reverse this whole process instead of bringing commercial publishers in at a reduced rate? The information that's being internally developed could be sent to an American publisher, could be translated, could be made available to this country and other European countries. In other words, role reversal, but yes, Actually a cooperative effort.
Yes. Well, that's what we do try to address. We're also working with having discussions with Google about digitizing African content to make it available. We're working also on this union. I can't remember the exact name of the program, but it's the catalog, the World Catalog
OCLC.
Project.
OCLC.
No. It's I'm sorry. The name has just gone out of my head. But it's to put online the catalogs of libraries around the world. So to increase the visibility of the content in developing countries.
So it's happening already.
Yes, that's okay. One of the areas that we're cognizant of. Now I know I'm conscious that some of you are need to leave soon, and I wanted to show you just a very quick.
Before you do, can I just intrude one more time?
Sure, but I'm stuck here.
As I had understood, in a sense, the problem, it has to do at a core level with the sensibility of the librarian and what the librarian sees as the mission. And as you identify it, it's binary. On the one side, you can take a balance that is shifted towards copyright, and the librarian has copyright enforcing. And on the other, the position for which you're advocating, that the librarian should be an advocate for open access. Mm-hmm. So when you see the task as mobilizing librarians, it's to mobilize librarians towards that sensibility, yes?
Yes.
And in doing that, the librarians effectively become client for the lawyers at the university. At least that's the possibility. I'm the general counsel of the university. I represent Harvard in the copyright councils of the world. I decide who to sue, what motions to quash, what legislation to support. To whom do I look for guidance from my client? Who is my client? And what is my client's sensibility? It seems to me that the task of mobilizing librarians is to focus that sensibility on the ways in which university meaningfully expresses it, which means, at least from a lawyer's point of view, focusing it on what the lawyers go out and do and what they fight for. So it translates to how can this position be expressed more effectively to the councils within the university?
And I think also, Charlie, within to the technologists, to the scientists who are creating technology that allows open access, easy open access. Like if it's solar panels, how to create cheap solar panels. So now the librarians are client to technologists and lawyers and scholars too, who create the sort of the story behind why the paradigm should shift. Because it's that kind, it was that public discourse that kind of created the climate of copyright in the United States in the 18th and 19th century, and which was very different from the climate of privilege in the 15th, 16th, and 17th centuries in Europe. So I see it as, you know, librarians as this node, very powerful node, through who are clients to all of these, but who can influence, who can send out power to change all of these areas. And I think that requires a change in the way librarians think about who they are and what they do, not just providing access, but shaping the world, creating something. That
I mean, I don't see librarians as being enforcers of copyright. I think we have a very strong, well, we have a very strong public interest role. We have a professional and ethical obligation to provide access to information and for also freedom of expression. And I think sometimes, and particularly in the countries, in developing countries, where librarians only hear one message, which is the problems with piracy and the problems with unauthorized copying, it's easy to lose sight of your role and your mission. And I think within a university setting, the librarian should be the advocate to the other, to faculty, to the council, for the public interest aspect of copyright to be to the fore.
All right, great. Let's see the video.
Now, my computer hung for a little while, but it seems to have woken up again. So let's just see if it works. I can't get it any larger on the screen.
I wish it comes one day that people have access to information, not only to electronic journals, but whatever they would like to have.
I wish people should find what they're looking for easily.
I wish we could have access to everything, because there's so much information out there.
My wish always is that information can be accessed at any time, anywhere, and any ways.
I wish more understanding, more open mind, in people.
I wish that the government will show more interest in libraries, because every other thing stems from that.
I wish that we can offer more online resources.
I wish also librarians could have a mindset that it is no longer a book that is meaningful in a library, but a virtual library.
We
think our role as universities is to make sure that we provide the access to knowledge and the means of training people for whatever field.
We try to provide them with other cultures to empower them to access to more information.
There is a big leap from just accessing information which is within our own home to accessing information that is worldwide.
Database is more efficient, more rich, and more fast, and open to more people than one physical book, which is on the shelf in the library.
Libraries are the gateways to the knowledge, to the information.
We live in information society, so information is the most important thing.
How to deal with this information in effective ways are very important for all of us.
Not easy task, but the results are so exciting that we are ready to do that.
I think the main obstacle is that in many of our countries, cooperation and resource sharing is not the tradition.
The major obstacle is, of course, financial.
I think that the main problem is financing.
The needs are always bigger than we can afford.
Poor ICT infrastructure.
We do have access, but it's very slow.
We have very serious power outages.
The main obstacle is an invisible one, and that is in the heads of the people.
This is a new thing, and lots of people have to understand what it's all about.
We really have to work hard to get staff enthused about what we are doing.
Old type of thinking, old type of approaching to these issues is the most difficult to overcome.
I must say, it was Eiffel which introduced electronic information to my country.
Our libraries gather in a consortium because of Eiffel. This is new.
So this is the only institutions providing electronic resources to Azerbaijan.
I try always to apply what I get from Eiffel and make it available and practical in my country and in my library.
Knowing, receiving, being trained by Eiffel can teach so many in your country.
I have participated in Eiffel from the beginning, since the year 2000, and I'm now with family and friends.
The people are so welcome here.
I really enjoy, not only personally, but also professionally.
People, institutions, minds, as well as problems together, and you solve them as a team.
It's very refreshing because we are updated on what is happening.
They are great events, gathering librarians, professionals from all over the world. Very productive because high quality professionals are gathering here.
I can learn something. Of course I can network. It's a very great opportunity.
It's fantastic, because it actually brings you to a world where you actually realize you're not alone.
We now go back to our various countries and try to tell them some of the new developments in the field of access to knowledge.
Thank you very much. Can we give her a hand?
Well, thank you also for inviting me, and for I hope it's been useful, and that we will remain in contact. Mm-hmm.